I gave you the name of my one really helpful professor at Dartmouth, a mathematician named Brown, and I'd forgotten his first name, which was Bancroft. And I forgot the name of the individual who did the experimental work on electrical saturation of dielectrics. And his name is F. Malsch, M-A-L-S-C-H. And the paper, if you care, was in the Annalen, this is Annalen, their physique, 84, 841, 1927.
I say it will be on the tape, so it's not important that I am.
Now, there are probably some other names I was supposed to give you, but I don't remember what they were.
Before I leave, I'd like to sort of go through a few of the spellings. We'll go down the list that I've been copying. Are there some things that you have found that you still want to tell me about?
Not really. The only thing I have here, I'll go down this list of names. I did once attend a set of lectures on biochemistry. That was fairly late in my career. Were given by Frank Putnam. Frank Putnam is now chairman of biochemistry in Indiana. And he was at the University of Chicago from 1947 to 52. Mm-hmm. And sometime during those years, I went in and sat in on his lectures on biochemistry. But I don't know exactly when. I'll look down this list of names. I don't think that I have. One of my good friends and among physical organic chemists all these years has been Frank Long. Who was at Chicago as a postdoctoral fellow with Harkins when I first arrived, or shortly after I first arrived as a research associate. I knew him vaguely then. We became quite good friends when we were both at Brewston during World War II. Mm-hmm. And I like his physical organic chemistry. I don't think he has made the great contributions that, for example, Winsheim made. But I like his work. I think, by and large, I've said everything I intended to say, and we'll sit back now and answer whatever questions you occur to.
Just a few sort of specific questions about and then we'll deal with a very general question. Did you, when you ever choosing them, or did you let them choose you, or how did the process evolve? Don't get your father in.
Certainly, where the demand greatly exceeded the supply. Graduate James chose me. What I did do in Chicago on several occasions was to stop people working with me when they had finished a master's degree. On the ground, I was not at all confident that they had the ability to get PhDs. In general, they went ahead and got PhDs through other people, and some of them have done very well since. So apparently my judgment was overly severe. At Harvard, where the number of graduate students was much larger, it was more of a bargaining process. And First, I turned down graduate students when I felt I had a large enough group. But sometimes, even then, someone would argue me into taking them on. And I was in a bad position to resist, remembering how I had argued Conant for taking me off. Sometimes I would deliberately try to discourage a student from working with me, on the ground that I didn't think he would do well with me. But usually, I think it was more the student's option than mine, even here.
The postdocs, how did you usually accept the postdocs?
Usually, though not always, these were people who applied to me. Sometimes I asked or wrote around, but usually they were people who applied. And pre-affirmative action, I just tried to select the one I thought was best without bothering to get all the documentation that one must now have to make an appointment at least at Harvard. I have, in general, not merely favored, but strongly favored Americans over foreign postdocs. I don't know that this is the way to get the maximum research done. And I'm not sure that I can make a full justification for having made that preference, but I did. So I've had relatively few foreign postdocs.
Once in your group, do you have some sort of a general methodology with respect to graduate students and their work? How closely did you supervise?
Yes, sir. I had a very I had a plan that I administered for many, many years, but in recent years I've slipped, and I wouldn't say I had done this recently. Early on, certainly at the University of Chicago, and early on here, I tried very hard to see graduate students quite regularly, a couple times a week, at the beginning of their work, and then tried gradually to withdraw, and tried to see to it that after a year or two, I didn't go to them at all, and waited for them to come to me. A little bit, I guess, on the principle of Kohler's proof. I tried to get people started
and then walk away slowly. Sometimes one couldn't walk away, and sometimes students were very eager to have you walk away much earlier. But I tried to make that as a principle. But I must confess that in the last few years I haven't adhered to that, and have left people very much more on their own, even at the beginning. Probably much more than I should have. It depends on the student, too. It really does.
Can you make any comparison between the general student 30 or 40 years ago and the graduate student today? Do you think they've changed significantly? Their attitude?
The students at Harvard certainly used to, at least, work a good deal harder. I think they still work a little harder than those did at the University of Chicago. Furthermore, the average quality of the graduate students I have had at Harvard was, I think, better than the average quality of the graduate student I had at Chicago. Brighter, as well as harder working. Until very recently, however, the best individual graduate student who had worked with me was at the University of Chicago, and in fact was Dan Koshner. There is now a graduate student sort of working with me. He's working 94% on his own, 3% with Woodward and 3% with me. He's in my labs, but he's in both our groups. And I think I've finally seen someone brighter than Dan. It remains, of course.
Can you identify him now? Sure.
A young man named Stephen Bennett. And that's a prediction.
Last name is
Bennett. B-E-N-N-E-R. That's a prediction. I claim that he's going to be a star.
Any other students over the years that we have not already talked about that
might
be mentioned?
I have had a fairly large number of students who have done at least well. And majority of those, or I think the large majority of them, have been in bioorganic chemistry. And I have been really very proud that at the Borden Conference on Enzymology, there have been 15 of my former collaborators who have been accepted and attended. That's sort of a measure of the success of this nature. Of the people who have worked with Koshman, Bob Avies, postdoc, and is superlative biochemist. Myron Bender. Then I have had some postdocs who were fairly well along when they came here. And I don't know how much credit I can claim. I think it goes the other way. But Bert Zerner, the Bert is a B-U-R-T, Bert. Erwin Fedovich, who is on the staff at Duke in biochemistry, is a full professor, I'm sure. Have been outstanding individuals. Tom Morton from Brown, who is in my laboratory now, assistant professor Brown, is, I think, going to turn out to be quite good. Then there's a whole list of people who are in academic life and carrying on bioorganic chemistry of one sort or another. I'd do better looking down the list than remembering off the top of my head, but I can give you quite a large number. Starting with Gordon Hamilton and Paul Hockey, and David Sigmund. Just pause while you write.
Yes. That might be better. Last one was David Sigmund.
Sigmund. And what?
Tom Kaiser.
Tom, yes.
Quite a reputation.
Yes. Tom Kaiser, of course. Harry Fry, the postdoc at EY. Who was a postdoc here and is now a professor at Ohio State, is really splendid. And Harvey Fisher, of course, has continued in bioorganic chemistry. Dave Mazurow from the University of Chicago Bay is on the staff at NAU. Is on the staff at Rockefeller and has done good work. I don't think it's quite good work. Aaron Novick, of whom we've spoken before, has turned biologist, so I haven't followed his work carefully, but I think has done really quite well. I'm a wild enthusiast for Barry Kugelman, who's at the University of Pennsylvania. I think he's going to turn out to be splendid. Peter Guthrie, who is at Western Ontario, is a real scholar. George Kenyon, a graduate student of me, and is now at the University of California Medical School in San Francisco, and is doing very pretty biochemistry. I'm going to look because I'm likely to forget there are a number of other people here who certainly were interesting and have done interesting work or doing interesting work. Charles McKenna may turn out to be a star. I don't know if he will or not. I mentioned Marion O'Leary, I'm sure, already. I don't see how I can make much claim on either Rochek or Samuel except say how pleased I was to have had them in these labs. Thornton at the University of Pennsylvania is doing all right. He's back in physical organic chemistry and not bioorganic.
Oh, on the contrary.
What?
On the contrary, he's probably even more so in bioorganic chemistry. He's working on the nervous system now.
I see. I didn't know that. And I'm pleased to hear it. I thought I had sort of lost him to bioorganic chemistry. Roberta Coleman at the University of Delaware, I haven't followed her work very well. Ed Dennis is at La Jolla, and Gerald is at Yale and has just begun. I think that he will do well. Gorenstein and Kluger are both physical organic chemists. Some biochemical overtone. Charlie Lerman's a very good teacher, but I don't know that he's ever going to turn out to be a great research man. Industry in the mark. Charlie Perrin is a pure physical organic. I don't want to say I lost him. There's a Stan Seltzer, I should have mentioned, who is at Brookhaven still and is doing very well. Eric Siegel, who's now just taking his postdoctoral at Caltech, is another one who I predict is going to be a star, although he will not be a supernova, and better might be. I don't know what to say. But, you know, there's a good bunch of people there who constitute a sizable fraction of the group doing bioorganic chemistry in the United States. You know, they constitute something like 10-12% of the people who show up at a Gordon conference on enzymology. That's really very gratifying. It goes without saying that I know very well the difficulty of attributing very much of that to what I taught them. What happens, of course, is that if someone gets started in a relatively new field, the people who are interested in that field gravitate to that laboratory. And then if they're good people, they do well afterwards. And question of how much influence any individual has on any other is open to question. There's a good deal of argument about whether, for example, Harvard is any better a university than Podunk. Because it turns out that bright people choose to come to Harvard. If they, for some unknown reason, got forced to go to Podunk, they might turn out just as well. Or they might not, I don't know. I think in the early days of physical organic chemistry, Paul Bartlett attracted a stream of spectacular people who came because if you were looking for a laboratory in physical organic chemistry in the United States, in the middle 30s, you didn't really have a wide choice.
Since you brought that up, what was the choice? Okay, assuming that you were going to run a conference on physical organic chemistry,
when?
Perhaps it's unfair. I'm going to give you some years. Perhaps it's unfair to ask you as early as 1930, because if you want to, you can speculate on 1930, 1935. Who would you invite?
In 1935?
Yes.
Well, in 1935, one had lost Kohler.
Okay.
So one couldn't have him. One would have started certainly with Hammett. One would have invited Lucas, who was easily visible at that time. One should have invited Karosh, who was visible by then. Mm-hmm. One would certainly invite Pauling. I think one would have invited Leland by 1950. Certainly would not have invited me. You would have not have invited Winstein. Now, if you reached outside the United States,
yes, we better do that.
One would certainly have invited Ingold, and one would have invited Hughes to the same laboratory. One might or might not have invited Robert Robinson. One would have invited Mervine. Trigay. Gene pointed out, probably a very young man at the time, but easily visible. You probably can do a better job of listing these people than I.
One of whom
I've omitted. Omitted.
Well, of course, Lapworth was still alive.
He died in 1938.
Yeah.
One might have invited Lapworth.
What about Whitmore?
Well, that's a splendid suggestion. Yes, indeed. Yes, I think one should have invited Whitmore.
You keep forgetting about him so often, I think.
Yes, one shouldn't forget about him. And I was wondering whether one would have invited Kai Paterson. I think his independent work, the important papers were the decarboxylation papers, the ones he did independently of Bronsted. And I don't think they came out that early.
Mm-hmm.
My recollection is correct. The major paper was 38. Now, whether anything had come out for 35, I'd have to check back to see.
Well, I haven't checked on Young's dates.
Young made much of a splash by then. Well, I think it's one of Lucas's students. I think one would have invited. Well, might have invited Young too, but one certainly would have invited Lucas.
Anyone else from the West Major. Coast that you can think of?
Well, I was trying to think when Calvin's name became prominent, and my guess is not that early. But but I don't honestly know.
By 1940.
Well, one certainly would then, by then.
you would have been on the list.
I think I would have been on the list. Winstein would have, I think, been on the list. When was Winstein? When were Winstein's papers with Lucas?
Probably the late 30s. Now, he was around here sometime in the early 40s.
I think one would have had Winstein on the list by then. I'm not sure. Probably Bill Young would have been on the list. Peterson would have been on the list. Or anyway, on my list by then. Whether one would have invited any other Ingalls collaborators or not, I don't know. Christopher Wilson. But it may be that that's too early for Chris Wilson. He may have surfaced more or less with Winstein.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that one would have included him.